And the person, I think the gentleman did a marvelous job as well.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks to you all. The third case is going to be taken on the briefs and the record, so we'll move on to the fourth case of the morning. And that's Carolyn McCullough versus Paul O'Neill. No longer Paul O'Neill, whoever he is. Mr. Lefko?
Yes. May it please the court, I'm Michael Lefko representing the plaintiff appellant Carolyn McCullough. And if I can have just a minute to get my notes in order here. The question in this case is whether the plaintiff's complaint should have gone to a jury. The district court judge said no and granted summary judgment. We believe, therefore, reasons why it should go to a jury and why the case should be reversed and remanded for that purpose. First, there is a trilogy of U.S. Supreme Court decisions preferring summary judgment in employment cases, and they are cited in our brief, and I'll just mention them briefly. It's Desert Palace versus Costa, the Reeves case, and the Hicks case. And I also want to mention in this court the Zaganini case, which was decided this year. In addition, two of the Supreme Court cases, Reeves and Hicks, explain what's necessary to send a case to a jury. If the plaintiff has made out a prima facie case, and in this case there's claims of race, color, sex, and age discrimination, and if there's an indicia of mendacity on the part of the defendant's witnesses, and we have explained at some length in our brief, in our reply brief, why there is in this case, that's sufficient to send the case to the jury for decision. In addition to the Supreme Court's decision, in this court's decision, I'd like to call the court's attention to a recent article by Professor Arthur Miller of Harvard Law School. I believe he's a writer, Miller, in the June 2003 New York University Law Review. And the title of it, briefly, is The Pretrial Rush to Judgment. And he looks at what's going on in the district and appellate courts and Supreme Court around the country concerning what he calls the hyper use of summary judgment.
Mr. Lefko, yes. How can this be considered an adverse employment action if Ms. McCullough would have been assigned to an equivalent position if she was not retained in her current position?
That's a good question, Judge. She was denied the opportunity to participate in pay banding in the future, which could have increased her salary up to approximately $30,000. That's discussed, I think, pretty thoroughly in our brief. She was denied because of she had to take, for medical reasons, she had to take, resign her position and take her early retirement. She lost the opportunity to participate in a very important federally health-sponsored plan, and she's uncovered for health insurance for a period of 8 years until she gets Medicare. And there's this case by this court, I think Judge Posner wrote the decision, the Heinen-Reiter case that we cited in our brief, where Judge Posner, the court, said the loss of future financial opportunity is a sufficient adverse effect and just is not that sufficient. There's no grounds to dismiss the case on that basis.
Now,
What is it she missed? What is it she didn't get the health coverage or some
she
other
missed her health coverage, right.
Why and not by keeping the same job?
That's the one reason. By keeping any job in the federal government, she lost her opportunity to participate in federally sponsored health insurance benefits.
But she kept her job.
Pardon?
She kept her job. I mean, she could have kept her job.
Well, she couldn't keep the taxpayer advocate job. That went to a white, younger white male. She's an older black woman.
But she had another job.
She had a temporary job, Judge. And she, that job could have been dissolved at any time. She could have been riffed. There was no assurance that she would have a position in the future. And then, when she was in the temporary job, see, she didn't have to get qualified for pay banding. You have to be a manager who supervises a supervisor who has subordinate employees. She was in a position that didn't have that. She could never have qualified for pay banding from the position she was in. And the writing was on the wall in this case. After she had been had high-level positions with the IRS, making $90,000 a year, in 27 years with the IRS, she knew her career was over when they turned her down. As the incumbent of the local taxpayer advocate here in Chicago, when they turned her down, she knew she wasn't going anywhere else.
Now, both Brazil and Rose said they couldn't remember talking to Lamar about her. But under your reasoning, it seems that that lack of recall is equivalent to a firm denial that those conversations ever took place. And I'm wondering what evidence there is that would support that interpretation, because it seems more like a simple lack of recollection by a witness. As if, you know, sort of as if to say, I could have had that conversation, I don't recall, rather than I never had that conversation.
The question you pose is exactly why the question, why this case should go to a jury, because a jury could go either way on this question. The jury could find these people are lying through their teeth, they're mandacious, they're high-ranking IRS employees, making probably as much as the U.S. District Court judges. They're called,
they're still underpaid.
Pardon?
They're still underpaid.
I'm sorry, Judge.
They're still underpaid.
I agree with you with regard to the district court judges.
I knew you would.
They knew they're going to be deposed. They knew what they're going to be deposed about. There's a deposition, and they don't remember hardly anything. In a high-ranking official, I think we have to expect more than that, and I think a jury probably would. Mr. Brazil, in 47 pages, had 115 non-responsive answers. Olga Rhodes, in a 58-page deposition, had 75 non-responsive answers. It's highly unusual. In addition to that, Rhodes was deposed, and I think July 12th or something of whatever the year was, and she couldn't recall anything. And 3 days later, she gave an affidavit, which is part of the record in this case, in which she remembered more. And 3 days before, she had exhausted her recollection. Now, I've made my point on it, Judge.
Is there any evidence that McCullough would ultimately have been assigned, if she hadn't retired, of course, to a position that was worse in terms of pay and advancement potential than the position she was denied?
Well, she was in such a position at the time that she took retirement, Judge. She was detailed to a position in which essentially she was an administrative aide in the Chicago office, a much, much lower position than she held. Would she ultimately have received another position? I think the inference would be for a jury that no, she wouldn't, in light of what had transpired in this case. If she had been a successful incumbent in the job as a taxpayer advocate, that's one of the issues of fact for the jury. The managers above her said, oh, there were some questions about whether or not she was really doing a good job. She said she was doing a splendid job, and there's evidence on both sides that should go to a jury. I see that my time is up. I did save some time for rebuttal. I just want to say one thing, that Mr. Hale, on behalf of the government, in his brief didn't cite the trilogy of cases that I mentioned. I think he's a very fine lawyer, and perhaps he has a reason for that, but I don't know what it is.
Thanks. Mr. Hale.
Morning. May it please the court, counsel. The district court properly granted summary judgment in this case on the basis that McCullough failed to clear several hurdles necessary to a prima facie case and because there wasn't any evidence of discrimination. On the record in the district court, there wasn't a hint of discrimination against Ms. McCullough. This reorganization was not directed at her. It was a nationwide reorganization of the Taxpayer Advocate Service. The idea was to improve the performance and the responsiveness of the Taxpayer Advocate Service. And as McCullough points out in her brief, the Senate Finance Committee was breathing down the neck of the IRS at the time, so they were under pressure to improve what they were doing. And it was undisputed in the district court. The Chicago district, where Ms. McCullough had been in charge, was the most troubled of all the districts in the Mid-States region. So it's not surprising that Mr. Lamar, the recommending official in this case, would at least consider the possibility of replacing Ms. McCullough in this position.
What's your best record evidence that she would have been given equivalent job if she had not been recalled to her old position?
That fact was undisputed in the district court, and we have a system of the material statements of facts, and you're supposed to cite your evidence on either side. We cited that, supported it with admissible evidence. They didn't contravene it, and the district court so found. So the record shows that she was guaranteed to come out of this assignment with a job at the same grade and pay as the job which she had. The problem with the facts that you're getting from Ms. McCullough, and it's the problem that was true in their brief, their statement of fact there is remarkable for the fact that it eschews record references. And what you're hearing on some of these things is just it doesn't relate to what is there in the record.
Did Lamar testify that he relied on written reviews of Ms. McCullough or oral statements of Brazil and Rose?
They were oral statements from Brazil and Rose.
Yeah.
And again, the record there, if you look at the record, there is no ambiguity there. The record is clear. They didn't remember those conversations specifically, but they didn't deny that they would take place. And they didn't deny that they did take place. This was a reorganization of the entire service. These were people who are participating in scores, if not hundreds of interviews, over a period of just a few weeks. So it's not surprising that they don't remember every conversation that they had. Lamar clearly did remember the conversations, and of course, the substance of the conversations, the facts about the problems with her performance in the Chicago office, are undisputed. And they were documented independently from the decision process here in her mid-year review and also in the reports to the Senate Finance Committee. Another fact which was discussed here today and in the brief, which just isn't borne out by the record, is this issue of pay banding. Now, the record is clear, undisputed, that pay banding was not available in 1999 at the time that this selection was made. It wasn't available to anybody at the IRS, and that was McCullough's own evidence that she presented. It's true that pay banding became available at the IRS about a year or 2 years later. It's unclear on the record whether it was a year or 2 years, but substantially later it became available generally for managerial level positions. So it's clear that she wasn't denied that opportunity for pay banding by losing out on this job, but if she had stuck around and gotten a permanent assignment, then she may well have gotten one to a managerial position where she would have been able to take advantage of pay banding, but it doesn't have anything to do with the decision at issue in this case. Instead of presenting evidence, what McCullough does is refer this court to a stack of depositions, a tall stack of depositions, and commend them to your reading. And that's after we pointed out in our, we quoted colorful language that you've used, making the point that that's counsel's job to come forward with whatever the facts are on which they rely. I think it's a safe bet that if there had been some facts here that showed discrimination, it would have been brought to your attention. For those reasons, we'd ask that the decision of the district court be affirmed.
Okay, thanks. Did I go? You got about a minute. Good.
Mr. Hale said there's no hint of discrimination and before the district court. We think that's incorrect, but I call the court's attention to the Zaganini decision in which the court said, we emphasize that the plaintiff's failure to bring any evidence regarding age does not defeat his claim per se. The special virtue of the indirect method of proof is that it allows victims of age discrimination to prevail without presenting any, and any is italicized, evidence that age was a determining factor in the employer's motivation. We think the same standard, with age is a factor in this case, and it applies to race and to sex and color also. There certainly is a dispute about her performance.
Surely you aren't arguing that you don't have to bring evidence of any kind of discrimination.
No. You have to prove it. You have to have a prima facie case, and you have to have some showing, and we think we have that with the mendacity of the IRS employees, who, if they don't know more than they showed in their depositions, I don't know how they're going to collect enough taxes to support it. There's one other thing I want to mention, and that is, he said that we didn't contest the assignment to a different position in our local Rule 56 statement. At paragraph 91A, we went into some detail about it. You'll find that at page 37 of that document. I thank the court again. I ask you to reverse the decision of the district court judge and remand for a jury trial.
Okay, thanks very much. This case will be taken under advisement.